to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Featuring stimulating in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative, exploring whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect everybody, both locally and globally. And for this, the Arts Hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And I combine a debate topic and an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. Well, this week as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing Andy Weir, New York Times best-selling author and recipient of the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer in 2016. Andy is known for his hugely popular hard science fiction novel, The Martian, which was made into an acclaimed feature film directed by Ridley Scott and starring Matt Damon and Jessica Chastain. Starting out working as a computer programmer for Sandia National Laboratories at the young age of only 15, Andy built a two-decade career as a software engineer working for such companies as AOL and Blizzard, where he worked on the video game Warcraft II: Tides of Darkness. Andy began writing in his 20s, putting various stories up on his website and continued writing through his years as a software engineer. The success of his first published novel, The Martian, allowed him finally to write full-time, and his latest book, Artemis, is a near-future sci-fi noir heist story set on the moon. The film rights to Artemis have already been acquired, and Andy has also penned a TV pilot that has been picked up by CBS. Andy describes himself as a lifelong space nerd and a devoted hobbyist of such subjects as relativistic physics, orbital mechanics, and the history of manned spaceflight, all of which contribute to the realistic feel of the worlds he creates in his fiction. He's going to be in Santa Cruz on the 5th of September at 7 p.m. for an off-site and ticketed event courtesy of Bookshop Santa Cruz. So if you are listening from this area, you will be able to see him in Santa Cruz very soon. He currently lives in Mountain View, California. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you've been writing much of your life, part-time while you were a software engineer and now full-time. I'm wondering if you can remember the first time that art had a deep effect on you, whether it was a piece of writing, a book, or some other kind of art.
Oh, boy. That would have to be a long, long time ago. I mean, of course, there's storybooks that my mother read to me as a child, like Dr. Seuss books. I mean, I remember there was some book, I think it was Country Mouse, City Mouse, not a Doctor Who. Did I say Doctor Who? I meant Dr. Seuss. I am a Doctor Who fan, by the way, a huge Doctor Who fan. But there was some book called, I think, like City Mouse, Country Mouse, kind of thing like that. And I remember at one point a cat attacks them, and every time my mom would turn the page to that, I'd be like, oh my God, I'm so surprised, even though I knew it was coming. It's strange being a kid.
Yeah, and that's some of the sort of magic, isn't it, of literature, how it can kind of bring us so much into the world, and you suspend that kind of sense of reality in a way so that you can be surprised every time, you know, and enjoy that.
Yeah, and with kids, when you're a kid, it's especially powerful.
Absolutely, yeah. You obviously had an aptitude for science from a young age. What made you also want to write?
I don't know. I never remember a time when I didn't write. I think I think the first stuff that I wrote was Henry and Ribsy fan fiction from the Beverly Cleary novels that I used to read when I was a little kid.
Aww.
So, on my dad's typewriter.
Huh. So there was always that kind of interaction for you on that level of writing. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Did you grow up in
I wanted to be a writer.
Did you grow up in a creative environment, would you say?
Well, I would say I grew up in a more scientific environment. My father was a physicist, an accelerator physicist, which means he shot beams of electrons at targets. And my mother was an electrical engineer. So I was pretty much doomed to be a nerd right from the get-go.
So I wonder where the interest in writing came from then. Was it from reading? I know you read a lot of science fiction when you were young.
Yeah, absolutely. My father was a science fiction dork, and I don't think he ever threw away a book. By the way, I'm talking about him in the past tense. He's fine.
Right, okay.
He's retired. I'm just talking about the past tense because this happened in the past. But I don't think he ever threw away a book in his life, and he had this bookshelf that was about 6 feet high, 3 feet wide, and a foot deep, jam-packed full of the sci-fi novels, the juveniles from the 50s, 60s, and 70s that he'd accumulated over his life. And so those are the books that I kind of grew up reading because I had ready access. It's awesome. I'd be like halfway through the book, and then there's just a laminated page in the middle that's an ad for Kent cigarettes. You keep going. That's we're talking books that came, you know, that were on shelves in 1958.
Wow. That's interesting. Remarkably, you began working as a computer programmer at 15 and you went on, as I mentioned, to have a successful career as a programmer. How do you see your love of science and the creativity of writing meeting inside you? Do they feel like two very different passions that you've put together, or are they more integrated for you?
I guess I'd say they're more integrated. I mean, they're both just different kinds of problem solving. Computer programming is all about achieving a desired result, right? Yeah. If you get the computer to do the thing, whatever it is that you wanted, then you have succeeded. But it's all about finding out how to get there and figuring out how to make it happen. And I found that writing is pretty much the same, or at least writing the way that I do it. It's all about, okay, I have presented this problem for the protagonist. Now, how do they solve it?
And I guess when you think about science in that way, which I think is probably more how scientists think about it, but people from the outside don't, it is actually quite creative, isn't it, science?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and software engineering, you know, computer programming is also a very creative thing, and it's done by people who don't realize that they're creative. So it's like I worked with many engineers over my 25 years, and there are a lot of really innovative and creative ways to solve the same problem that are all different. And every engineer tends to think along scientific lines, so they're like, well, this is the correct answer. But it's like saying, well, this is the correct painting. Well, no, there's a lot of different ways, and they don't realize the artistry that they have within them. And it's too bad.
Yeah, that's true. While you were saying that, I was trying to think of this quote that I read about creative people and how they actually really like problems. I mean, problem's probably the wrong word for it, because they to them it's just this sort of like banquet of like, right now I have to get in there and find out how to make this work. That's one of the things that differentiates creative people. I don't know whether you ever thought about that.
No, I never really thought about that. In fact, I always thought that's more what differentiates the really scientific people, the sorts of people who just really love to solve a problem. You're like, you know, at some point somebody's, you know, the Wright brothers were like, I bet you we can figure out how to make something fly. How do we work this out?
Yeah. What attracted you to science fiction as a genre in which to write? Was it the fact that you read so much and that you were in science?
Yeah, I think so. Early indoctrination, I suppose. Also, I'm in a little niche of like hard science fiction where, you know, the science is as accurate as possible. And I guess that's what I'm a fan of, so that's what I write. Every writer should, I think, try to write a story that they themselves would like to read.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you what appeals to you about writing what is known as hard science fiction rather than inventing future science?
Well, I mean, there's always a little bit of fudging of the rules, right? But I think what appeals to me about hard sci-fi is that it keeps its sense of realism. It's easier for the reader, or at least if I'm the reader, it's easier for me to suspend disbelief when the physics and science and everything is real. And it's like, yes, okay, yeah, that could happen. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And also as a writer, it makes things a little easier for me because it means I don't need to make up fake physics on top of my prior fake physics to explain problems that I come up with. The real world provides all the rules that I need to follow when solving the problem.
Right.
So instead of trying to figure out when a warp core will or won't explode, I can, you know, just say, like, all right, here's a problem that exists in the real world. Let's look at some geniuses who have tackled the problems and made a career of it and how they solved it.
Yeah. So for readers not familiar with your work, is there any science in your books that isn't factual, or is it all factually based?
Well, I try to make it as factual as possible, but I did cheat a little bit here and there. Artemis is actually very solid on the science. I think that any inaccuracies in Artemis are going to turn out to be mistakes on my part, like not deliberate cheating, right? But in The Martian, there are a few, you know, cheats. And one of them was that the storm at the beginning, which is this huge windstorm that threatens to knock over their ascent craft and it hurts Mark and it does all the stuff that sets up the story, that could never happen on Mars. In real life, Mars's atmosphere is so thin that even 150-kilometer-an-hour winds, which Mars does get, would barely have enough force behind them to knock over a piece of paper. So it just, like, nothing like that storm could possibly happen. And I knew I was cheating when I wrote it, but
So art won out over science in that case.
Call the cops.
Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, award-winning author Andy Weir. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back very soon after these messages.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com. It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, Andy Weir, New York Times best-selling author known for his hugely popular novel, The Martian. And we heard from Bookshop Santa Cruz in the break there. And I just wanted to let you know again that Andy is going to be coming to Santa Cruz, if you're listening in this area, on the 5th of December, 7 p.m. for a book talk and signing. It's an off-site event. It'll take place at Santa Cruz High School, courtesy of Bookshop Santa Cruz. It's going to be a very popular event, so do get tickets in advance, either in store at Bookshop Santa Cruz or at their website, bookshopsantacruz.com. So again, that's 5th of December, 7 p.m. You can meet Andy Weir in person. So Andy, you started writing in your 20s and published work on your website and worked on comics and tried and failed to get a novel published. I'm wondering what sustained...
That's not kind.
Well, it's true though, isn't it, or not?
Quite accurate.
So, I'm not, obviously you're very successful now. I'm not telling this story and then, saying, and why have you still not published a novel, Andy?
Can you explain your continued failure?
Yeah, exactly. So I think contextually we're okay here. What I'm wondering is how you sustained your creative impulse to write through the years before you got published. And this is relevant to a lot of people, because there's a lot of people who want to write and get published, and it takes a long time sometimes. So I thought they might like to know what sustained you, and did you have a consistent desire to be a writer, or did it wax and wane?
It was consistent. I always wanted to be a writer, but I never pursued it as a full-time career because I like regular meals. And so basically I was always a software engineer first and a writer second. I don't know why the drive was always there. It was just always consistently an interest for me. Mm. And I would say what ultimately kind of kept pulling me through, I guess, was, I don't know about other writers, but I think I suspect most writers like me are driven by the desire to have an audience.
Yes.
We want other people to experience our stories. And once the internet kind of came into being, I could start posting stories on my website and getting feedback from readers. And that was really kind of satisfied that need inside. Mm. It was like, other people have experienced this story, and sometimes they write to tell me that it sucked. But the point is, they experienced it.
Yes, yeah.
And so that pulled me through a lot, and I kept writing and writing and started getting positive feedback. And I think a large part of it is there's no shortcut. Like, you have to, put in your 10,000 hours, so to speak. You have to be bad a lot until you start getting a little good.
Yes, yeah. No, I think that's very true. And, it's sort of become a bit more common to sort of study writing now, doing an MFA or whatever. But of course, historically, writers didn't do that. They read a lot and wrote a lot, So I think that still is a really solid way to become a good writer.
Well, studying and getting an MFA and stuff gives you a leg up, but also it's just a fancy and directed way to put in that time.
That's right? True. Yeah. Yeah. Sort of a structured way. Yeah.
It's faster and more efficient, but still you're putting in the work.
Yes. Yeah. No way around that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Your first published novel, The Martian, obviously hugely successful, but it had sort of an unusual path because you pursued it first with the Kindle. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, actually, before the Kindle, it was a serial that I was posting to my website, a chapter at a time. And I had about 3,000 regular readers who I'd accumulated over 10 years of posting short stories and comics and whatever else. And so it was, again, it was one of the things that was really encouraging. Every time I'd post a new chapter, I'd get, 100 emails saying, like, hey, I'm enjoying this. Keep it up, That really helped with my motivation. And also I would get people saying, hey, you messed up the chemistry in this part. So I had like 3,000 fact checkers, which was fantastic. When I eventually finished it, I had I had long ago given up the idea of ever being a published author. This was just now purely a labor of love. Mm. And I got emails from people. Once I'd finished it, I planned to just move on to other serial projects, but I got emails from people saying, like, oh, hey, I want to, I like your story, but I don't want to read it on your website, and, which is fair. My website sucks. It's really not that good. It's just very raw. It's just like white background with blue hyperlinks and, you know, raw text. And they said, could you make an e-reader version of it so I could read it on my e-reader?
Yeah.
So I did that, and I posted that to the site, and I'm like, there you go. But then other people emailed and said, oh, hey, I love your writing, hate your site, of course. I see you have an e-reader version, but I'm not very technically savvy, and I don't know how to download a thing from the internet and put it on my e-reader. Can you just post it to Amazon? So that's how I ended up posting it to Amazon. And then Amazon makes you charge at least 99 cents. And so that's what I set the price. I wanted to give it away for free, but you're not allowed to.
Right.
And so I charged 99 cents, the absolute minimum. And it started really selling very well. I'm sure part of it was that it's a low price point, right? And it's just a buck. And another part is people are just willing to pay a buck to not have to figure out how to manually load things onto the Kindle. So, yeah, it sold really well, and that ultimately got the attention of an agent, and so then I had an agent, and that got the attention of Crown Publishing, a division of Random House, and then Fox came in for the film rights, and everything kind of snowballed from there.
That's interesting. I mean, it just shows you how you should just follow your own path, because I know I've read that they've said you should never publish anything self-published, because then you will never get an agent and you will never get a traditional publisher to pick up something that's already been published on Kindle. So it just shows you.
That's not true.
Clearly.
They do, of course, want the rights. So, like, when Crown acquired the rights, they said, all right, we want you to take that down now.
Right, yes.
Until we're ready to do a proper release and stuff.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, it's a whole new world. I mean, there hasn't been a disruption, and I mean that in the positive sense.
Yeah.
A disruption in the literary world like this ever. I mean, that I know of. It's that there's no longer an old boy network in publishing. There's nothing between you and the readers. Nothing.
Yeah.
You can, for absolutely zero financial risk, you don't have to pay a cent. You can put your stuff out there for people to read. And if it's good and if they like it, they'll recommend it to each other and it'll float up. And then you can go to publishers and agents and say, look, here, I sold 10,000 units. This is something you should pay attention to.
Yeah. The Martian gained further reach by being made into a hugely popular film with Matt Damon, directed by iconic director Ridley Scott. And I know it's sometimes difficult letting a book go to be made into a film because you don't know how things might change. But how did you feel about Ridley Scott being the director?
Oh, well, obviously I was thrilled. and you know, every part of this still seems like some sort of fantasy daydream that couldn't possibly be real. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Even now, it doesn't really seem real to me. The checks are real, though. And so,
yeah.
they just go right through at the bank. So, I mean, I guess I got to believe it.
Yeah. No, I could see how that would feel like that. Because, you know, your first book and to, you know, have those amazing stars and that director. And yeah, it's gone well. Your latest book just coming out is called Artemis and is set on the moon. Could you give listeners a taste of the story without giving too much away?
Sure. Artemis is the name of humanity's first city that isn't on Earth. It's the only city on the moon. It's near the Apollo 11 landing site. It's a tourist attraction. The whole economy of the city is based on tourism. It's a small town. It's got about 2,000 regular residents, not including all the tourists that are there. And the main character is a woman who is a small-time criminal and smuggler, and she gets in way over her head.
It's a very interesting book. I'm about two-thirds of the way through. I'm really enjoying it. So,
well, I hope you like the last third.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think I will, because it's going along, chugging along right now. It's page turner, definitely. With a
That's
focus. Sorry.
I said that's the goal.
Yes.
When I'm writing, if I remember writing a paragraph, I imagine the reader up late at night, like it's 3 in the morning, and they're like, okay, I have to put this book down and go to sleep. at which paragraph is the one that they're reading when they decide, okay, it's time to put the book down and go to sleep because I'm exhausted. Okay, if I feel like I'm writing that paragraph, I ask myself, do I really need that paragraph? Don't let them put that book down. Keep them up all night.
That's interesting. That's a really good way to think about it. Yeah, because that is what happens when you really like a book, isn't it? At some point,
yeah.
I mean, you either just sort of, you know, pass out or you do hit something. I never thought of it like that. That's interesting.
Yeah, you sleep on your own time. When you've got my book, I don't want you going anywhere.
With a focus on very detailed world building and real science, I'm wondering if story drives your writing or whether the narrative comes more organically from the worlds that you first create?
That's a real good question. I would say that I definitely start with the world building because I want the plot to work around the setting, not the other way around. Readers are a lot smarter than people give them credit for, and they're a lot smarter than they themselves know. They can sense when you have tweaked the setting to be convenient for the plot. They can sense that at some deep visceral level, and they just kind of, it erodes their suspension of disbelief just a little bit and makes them enjoy the novel less. So for me, I say like, okay, I've got to start with the setting. These are the rules of this universe. And then I come up with the story. So for The Martian, I came up with kind of the mission profile of a manned Mars mission. And then I worked on, like, okay, and then here's what's goes wrong. Okay, go. For Artemis, I actually designed the entire city, the economics, its history of how it got constructed, the ownership, the whole model, everything before I invented any characters or plot. So when I write it, you know, for me now, Artemis is as real as, like, Chicago. If I were writing a book that takes place in Chicago, I can't just change Chicago to suit the setting. I have to work within what is already defined there, right?
Right, yeah.
I guess it's setting-based. I hope that answered your question. I'm not sure if I did.
Yeah, no, it did, totally. Yes, yeah. There's a lot of science in the book, which makes the world seem very real, and you obviously put a lot of research and effort into it, as you're saying. How do you decide how much scientific detail to give and how much might be too much for a sort of broad readership?
That is an extremely difficult challenge for me because to me, all this stuff is super interesting. To other people, maybe not so much. So I have to temper it. And so, I would say, without exaggeration, probably only about 1% of all the stuff I worked out about Artemis made it into the book. The rest of it is back there.
Yeah.
And it's ready if needed. But I try to just remember my rule of, if it doesn't service the plot, don't tell the reader about it.
Right. So, yeah. You know, That's interesting. So once you have the world, once you have that, then your story becomes the primary thing, and it's the world is serving the story at that point. So to go back to the other question, yeah.
And it's kind of like going back to my Chicago analogy. If I have something take place in Chicago, I start by saying, okay, it's Chicago. And then, you know, maybe I don't just, you know, I can't just assume that the reader knows all about Chicago. So it's like, well, I took Canal Street to, you know, down to the waterfront and, you know, the lakefront district or whatever.
Yeah. Right?
You can describe the geography as the character is moving around. And then you say, like, maybe, oh, and I passed the Willis Tower, which, of course, everyone here still calls the Sears Tower. And it was the tallest building in the world for a while. You know, there's little snippets here.
Yes,
there that you can't. But you don't start off with Chicago started out as a trading post in 1740.
Yes. you go into obviously detail in every way, but it's quite interesting about the food that they eat, and you know, depending on your economic status, what food you can afford, and how coffee can't be served hot because of how you know things work on the moon. Are these things that you just know already, or do you kind of go looking for that kind of detail?
Well, I go looking for the detail. One of the biggest things that helped me in Artemis, and this is another one of those things that's under the hood, was calculating the cost of shipping freight to the moon within the fictional setting. And it worked out to be, I'll just tell you, you can get about, it costs $160 in 2015 dollars to ship 1 kilogram to Artemis. which is way the hell cheaper than we could possibly do in the real world.
But yes,
whatever. And so if you start thinking about, like, okay, well, a typical meal, like dinner, is probably going to be about 500 grams, you know, so that's about $80 just in shipping. That's more than most people can afford for 3 times a day. Right,
yeah.
So that became clear to me, and I'm like, well, okay, this presents a problem because we have people who, you know, can't possibly afford that. So what do they eat? And so that's when I came up with the idea of gunk, which is just a chlorella algae that can be grown in vats. And algae grows very quickly, and it doubles its population every, it depends on the species, but very quickly.
Mm.
And chlorella is actually, although it tastes awful, and I've tasted it.
A lot of people take chlorella on Earth now.
yeah. It is actually, like, fantastically nutritionally balanced for humans.
Yeah.
And you can even fine-tune it when you're growing it. You can, it depends on, you know, how much of what frequencies of light it gets and what nutrients are in its bath will define how much of the chlorella algae turns stuff into proteins versus how much it turns into sugars. So you can actually, like, really, really make it perfect for human consumption. Still tastes awful, though.
Yes, I imagine. The community on Artemis is small, but very diverse, and they all rub along somehow. Where did the inspiration come from for creating the feel of the settlement?
Well, two kind of disparate sources. First off, the economy. I based it off of, the economy in general, kind of social breakdown, is based on, like, Caribbean resort towns. Right. You've got your ritzy hotels and casinos for the tourists. And then behind that, you have the more modest accommodations of the residents. Right.
Yeah.
And so that's what Artemis. And I think that's just emergent human behavior. That's how it's going to be in any tourist based economy town. But then there's also it's also in another way similar to, like, a frontier town in 19th century America, where basically, it is, you mentioned, diverse. It's intensely international. I mean, there are no rules on who can or can't go there. If you can afford to get there, you can be there. So it is in that sense, like America in the pre-immigration rules days, where, you know, early 1800s, it's like, all right, here's a small town out on the prairie. You've got people from literally all over the world who just, like, they're there because they were able to get there.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Interesting. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, my special guest from the arts this week, New York Times bestselling author Andy Weir. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel, and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, and my special guest from the arts this week, Andy Weir, New York Times best-selling author known for his hugely popular hard science fiction novel, The Martian. And before the break, we're talking about his new novel that's just come out called Artemis. And just want to remind you, if you're listening from the local area, that Andy is going to be in Santa Cruz on the 5th of December, 7 p.m. Santa Cruz High School, courtesy of Bookshop Santa Cruz. And it's going to be a very popular event, so you need to get tickets in advance, either in store at Bookshop Santa Cruz or at the website bookshopsantacruz.com, and you can meet Andy in person. So in the new book, Artemis, you've chosen to write a female protagonist from the first person perspective. Did you feel nervous at all about tackling a female perspective, particularly using her own voice?
Overwhelmingly so, yes.
But it didn't stop you.
Didn't stop me, but it was my single biggest concern when writing the book. My biggest insecurity was because So what happened was, let me explain.
Uh-huh. Okay.
What happened was, I designed the whole city of Artemis, and then I said, okay, it's time to design the plot and the characters. So I came up with a story idea. I outlined kind of a story that I wanted to have happen, and I needed a kind of a likable smuggler, rogue, underworld type character that was just going to be in two or three scenes. And so Artemis is an intensely international city, so I kind of spun the globe and picked a country at random, and I'm like, oh, Saudi Arabia. All right. And we'll make her a woman. Why not? And that's kind of how I invented Jazz. And she was a very, very minor character in that first revision of the story. Now, for reasons unrelated to Jazz, that revision didn't work out. I didn't like the way it just didn't fit right. So I made another revision, using some elements from the first one that I liked, changing things that I didn't like, ditching out characters that I didn't think worked, bringing in new characters, and so on. And I brought in Jazz, and this time she was a little more prevalent. I would say she was sort of a secondary character, still not the main character. But this, and so I had to build a little more backstory for her, but not much. I mean, she still was minor. But that second story idea didn't work out either. I just didn't like it. I didn't think it was working. But then I realized, Jazz is interesting. And I like crime novels. Crime novels and capers and heists and stuff are probably my second favorite genre of story.
Right.
My favorite being science fiction, right? And so I was like, well, who says I can't have a science fiction crime novel?
Yeah.
What if I made Jazz the main character and followed her adventures? And so that's what became Artemis. And by that time, she was so cemented in my mind as who she was, a Saudi-descended woman who grew up in Artemis. And so my imagination would have rebelled at me if I'd tried to change her into something more familiar to me, right? If I tried to change her into a man or anything like that. So it's not like I sat down and tried to be politically correct or inclusive or anything. I just ended up with, I'm like, okay, I'm going to be writing a first-person narration from a woman's point of view. That's what's happening now. And the way I tackled it was kind of the way I tackle anything else I don't really understand, which is subject matter experts.
Right.
If I want to know about welding, I talk to a welder. Well, if I want to know about women, I talk to women. And so what I did was, after writing the book, I gave the manuscript to every woman in my circle of trust, like every woman I could trust not to put it up on the Pirate Bay, right?
Right, yeah.
My mother, my girlfriend, my editor is a man, but his boss is a woman, and his assistant is a woman. The copy editor is a woman, and normally copy editors are told, hey, don't just check for spelling and grammar errors. Don't do it. But I said, we're going to have an exception to that rule. I want you to tell me about the realistic nature of this, you know, whether or not this scanned is a real woman. But the publicist is a woman. See, this is, fortunately, the publishing industry is actually very, very female dominated. So there were lots of women in the company and stuff who could read it and give me feedback. And I made changes accordingly. I'm sure Jazz still comes off as a bit like a guy here and there, but I'm not looking for, you know, no woman is going to read Artemis and go like, wow, Andy really understands women. I just wanted to be good enough not to pull female readers out of the story.
Right.
You know, I want them not to be alienated by it.
Yeah.
That's the best I can hope for as a man because I spent my whole life as a man.
Yes. Yeah. Well, no, I think you definitely achieved that. So definitely. Yeah. Doesn't throw you out of the book. And of course, you know, women are hugely diverse, just as men are. So, you know, there's probably, you know, some women who are more sort of gung-ho and tomboyish or whatever who, you know, would think one thing of Jazz, and then some who, you know, are on the other end of that spectrum who'd be like, wow, I would never be like that, you know. But, I mean, it's just everyone's individual, aren't they? So,
yeah, well, absolutely. And also, speaking on the other bit that we didn't really touch on is Jazz is ethnically Arab. She was born in Saudi Arabia and lived there until she was 6 years old, and then her father and her emigrated to Artemis. Well, so fortunately for me, I didn't have to deal with anything culturally complicated like that because Jazz is like, again, I use the immigrant example from early America, which is that Jazz grew up in Artemis. So her culture is Artemisian. She's like her dad, and you see this all the time in America, right? You see like, okay, you've got a family comes over from another country, their kids are like completely Americanized, and the parents still kind of have some of the old norms. And that's the case with Jazz and her father. So I didn't have to deal with like making a convincing Saudi personality.
Yeah.
So that I have her, she's from a culture that I made up. So I'm by definition right on that part.
Yes. Yeah. Good move. And, yeah.
And as for ethnicity, well, you probably know there's like little to no sexism or racism within Artemis, and that's not intended to be some idyllic utopia thing. I think that is again emergent human behavior. When you have a very small community,
you have to get along.
I know it's a weird thing to say, but racism is a luxury that a community can only have if it's larger than a certain minimum population. When you're small enough that you're all interdependent and rely on each other, there's just no room for it.
So I'm not saying
this is some beautiful future without racism. There's probably plenty of racists living in Artemis. They're just like, well, I don't like that ethnicity, but he's the guy who sells shoes, so
I have to get over it. Yeah.
I got to get over it if I want shoes.
Yeah. I'm sure there's something we can draw from that to help America, but not quite sure what it is right now.
That's what it was like in the early days of America, of course. In the early 1800s, racism was inherent and culturally acceptable and stuff like that. Yet America still managed to be full of a bunch of groups that in other countries, you know, actively killed each other. And in America, they're like, I'll buy some apples.
Yes. Both your novels are set in space. You've described yourself as a space nerd. What is it about space that fascinates you?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I don't have a really good answer. I got to go back to saying just all the juveniles that I read of my dad's sci-fi collection. And for your listeners who don't know, the science fiction stories from the 50s and 60s were often called juveniles because the target audience was young. Well, young men really was the target audience. They only later dimly realized women can like science fiction.
Right. People. Yeah.
But so I grew up reading like my Holy Trinity is, you know, Heinlein, Asimov, and Clark. And so, and all their stuff was about space, pretty much.
Yeah.
So I guess to me, that's what speculative science, you know, future, I guess speculative fiction is a different thing. But
yes,
for me, that's what science fiction is.
I mean, I guess it does give you an environment where your imagination can reign more freely, doesn't it? Because it's not here. Yeah.
I get to make up all the rules.
Yes. Yeah. But I understand you don't like flying, so you're not going to be going to space anytime soon.
Oh, no, not at all. No, I write about brave people. I'm not one of them. but as I talk to you right now, I'm in Houston, and I'll be flying back to California tomorrow morning, so...
Oh, wow. Well, good for you.
Yeah.
Oh,
thank you.
I'm interested in the work of the psychologist Alice Miller, who's written a lot about how art can help people process difficult events, whether these are events they've experienced or they've witnessed. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on art having a healing effect, both on those making art and those experiencing it, whether, you know, you've been aware of that at all in your life with your engagement in both writing and being exposed to art.
I think it definitely, for me, writing has been therapeutic in a lot of ways. I was a very lonely person for a long period of my life. I had moved to the East Coast after spending my whole life on the West Coast for a job, and I didn't have any friends, and I was by myself. And I'm a very social guy, so it's tough on me when I don't have people to hang out with. Mm. And I think a lot of that, it ended up funneled into The Martian, you know, that feeling of isolation and loneliness. And it was therapeutic, I think, a little bit. For Artemis, many people think that I created Jazz as a character of like, oh, the ideal woman for me or something. But actually, she's much more a reflection of me. All my life I've been told that I'm really, really intelligent. And this is a prevailing theme throughout the book, is that Jazz is extremely intelligent and doesn't make use of it.
Right.
She's lazy. She's very flawed. She makes bad decisions. She's very intelligent, but she doesn't make intelligent choices. She's full of regrets. She's made mistakes in the past that she feels guilty about and stuff like that. And I have all of that. Jazz is very much, very similar to the way I was when I was in my 20s, which is, in short, a screw-up. The only difference is that Jazz is kind of overconfident, and when I was in my 20s, I was kind of underconfident. But so there are some differences. But if you met me when I was in my 20s, you would find me strikingly similar to Jazz. I mean, obviously not physically, but...
Right.
The inner workings are very, very similar.
I mean, I think that's
maybe
one of
I'm,
go on.
Maybe I'm kind of facing or dealing with that by writing this. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, from your perspective, as you're saying, that is somewhat maybe therapeutic, but also I think one of the things, particularly with literature, is the element of empathy that, you know, when you're reading something, you can get an insight into different characters and experiences that can sometimes broaden your understanding and your worldview as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you've experienced with reading, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it has to be like really, really good writing. and you find that sort of... No, I mean, seriously, to have a character with enough depth that I end up empathizing with them and then seeing their transition and then understanding something I never really got before.
Right. That's
really good writing. And writing that I don't think I'm up to that level yet, but I'm always trying to improve my craft, which is why Artemis is so much more interpersonal complications and hopefully deeper characters than The Martian. Like no one would accuse The Martian of being literature, and really no one would accuse Artemis of being literature either. But I'm working on it. You know, I want to keep getting better.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great goal to have. And I think, you know, it's very well written. I mean, in terms of story and the characters and everything. So you're doing well. You're on the right trajectory there. In my opinion, anyway. It's one person's opinion. But it's a very enjoyable book. And you've said that you want people to just get to the end of the book and feel that it was a cool story. So rather than, you know, sort of making a big point, and certainly where I've got to, I feel like that's what I'm going to feel at the end. So we'll see.
Yeah, that's my goal, is just to entertain. I never have any, I don't have a moral. There's no political angle. There's nothing. It's just pure entertainment.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going for.
Well, and I mean, that's a lovely thing to have, I think, you know, to have that book that just in that moment is just takes over your world. And like you say, you can't put down. It's really fun to find a book like that, definitely.
Yeah, that was my experience with pretty much every Terry Pratchett book, you know, fantasy writer. So it's funny, I don't want to write fantasy at all, but I sure enjoyed reading Pratchett.
Right, yes, yeah. We've just got like a minute left of the show, so I just wanted to ask you, what's next for you? And are you already working on it, or are you having a well-deserved break?
Well, I am already working on it, but I don't have a contract for it yet because I want my well-deserved break. But I'm working I'm working at my own pace on a sequel to Artemis. I would like another story that takes place in the same city, because the reviews I see, even the ones that don't like Artemis, say, but the setting is really awesome.
Oh, yeah.
I want to write another story that takes place in Artemis, but not necessarily with the exact same. But, you know, Jazz isn't the main character.
Right, yeah. Oh, interesting.
I would like to write a lot of stories that take place. I'd like to write a series of books and have Artemis be my personal sandbox where I can have a whole bunch of things take place.
Great. Oh, well, I look forward to that, because it is a wonderful world that you've created. Well, thank you so much, Andy, for taking the time to come and talk to us. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
And I just wanted to let readers know again that if you're in this local area, Andy is going to be coming to Santa Cruz on the 5th of December, 7 p.m. Go to Bookshop Santa Cruz store or their website, bookshopsantacruz.com, for more details. And remember, you can go and visit the show website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, to find podcasts of all previous shows. Thanks for being with me, and I look forward to being with you again next time.